22-4028. I'll pronounce it Rees versus Folks. Counsel for appellant, please make your appearance and proceed.
Would someone grab the back door? Thank you.
Randall Richards, I represent Freddy Reyes.
Reyes, sorry.
Thank you. I would like to respectfully request a rebuttal, reserve a 3-minute rebuttal time. May it please the court. This case is an appeal from a summary judgment dismissal on the pleadings. And this is a 1983 case. The lower court determined that the defendant was entitled to qualify immunity. The allegations, the magistrate court said the allegations were insufficient, not covered, and didn't constitute a violation of constitutional right. Now, I would submit that that's incorrect. In the case of bar number one, both it's important to note that we clearly established a number of facts, all of which would indicate that constitutional rights of my client were impinged upon, violated.
Mr. Richards, let me sort of frame this issue for myself.
Okay.
We are dealing with essentially, you said, motion for judgment on the pleadings. And so we're limited to the averments essentially of the complaint. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. And therefore I'm puzzled by some of the arguments that I detected in your appellate brief that seem to rely upon facts that were not in the complaint. For example, it refers to officers drove, quote, an open air OHV on a steep and muddy dirt road. I didn't see any reference to a steep and muddy dirt road in the complaint. And so those facts are irrelevant, are they not?
Well, I think that we did say that they drove in a dangerous manner and caused went off the road. We did allege that in the complaint, went off the road, hit a fence post and caused significant damage to my client.
You did, but facts matter, and steep and muddy road are facts that are not in the complaint, right?
That is correct.
Okay.
That one thing we didn't include.
Well, but, you didn't describe what was dangerous about the driving either, did you?
Well, we just said that this officer that put my client in the OHV and then drove recklessly.
You didn't say reckless.
Or dangerously. Causing this.
But it wasn't clear to me what we're supposed to infer from that. What was, what we don't know in what way he drove dangerously.
Well, number one, he drove dangerously because he was driving a OHV without putting my client in seatbelts and shoulder harness. I think that in and of itself, even if it was on a...
Well, that's alleged.
That is alleged, absolutely.
Would you have the same position if your client would have been in a patrol vehicle, like a car?
If... he was not buckled in, yes.
Okay.
I mean, that's the problem. We have a situation where my client is put into a OHV, like a razor. As you know, those are open-sided. There's nothing to, you know, like windows that you could... would keep you in.
Don't presume a lot of knowledge about OHVs with me, but but nevertheless... You focused on the failure to buckle in.
Yes.
Well, we have a case called Brown versus Larson, unpublished case, mm-hmm. in which the panel for our court had collected a number of cases in which it was determined that the failure to buckle in standing alone is insufficient to raise a substantial risk of harm. And so Why isn't that case persuasive? I know it's not binding, but why isn't that case persuasive here? Because what Butler said, Brown says, I'm sorry, what Brown says is that absent allegations of recklessness beyond the failure to buckle in, there's an insufficient basis to show objectively a substantial risk of harm. So why isn't that persuasive here?
Well, because we did claim dangerous. He was driving dangerously.
But back to what Judge Hart said, there are no underlying facts in the complaint to allow us to understand what dangerous means. And under Iqbal, you can't just plead conclusions. You have to, you know, dangerous could mean anything to anybody, and you need to have underlying facts to support that, right?
But the underlying fact in this case would be that he ultimately drove off the road and hit a fence post. So I don't know how you can drive safely and not recklessly and do that.
Well, that could be an accident. A deer could have run out from under in front of him, and he swerved off to hit the post. Someone else could have been on the road and encroached onto their side. I mean, there are lots of reasons why you might end up off the road and into a fence post that aren't a result of your own dangerousness.
Well, I understand there's those possibilities. None of those were raised in the answers or anything of that nature.
I mean, they raised the argument that you just made a conclusion and that you didn't support it with facts, though.
Well, I think, like I say, the fact that he was driving fast enough that the collision caused extensive physical injuries to my client would indicate that he was going too fast for conditions.
Do you have any allegations as to how fast he was going?
We don't know how fast he was going, other than he hit that post so hard that it shattered my client's shoulder, and those allegations were in there. I think there's no question that in this case, the officer arrests my client for DUI, even though later it showed that there was no substance in his blood that would impair his driving. And I think it's incredibly important to note that he put my client, and this was alleged in the complaint, he put my client in the front seat of the OHV. He had him in handcuffs like this, and then those cuffs were hooked to a belly chain, which means if he's driving along and just hypothetically makes a quick left turn, the guy rolls out, there's nothing he can do to stop. If he hits a post or a tree, he can't put his hands up to do that. He just dives into it because he's helpless as a young child. And I think that in and of itself, the fact that he was both cuffed and belly chained in would indicate to anybody that it's dangerous to drive.
Well, it hasn't made that indication for a number of panels of courts that have determined that the failure to buckle in standing alone, and I would have to go back and comb those cases, but I would wager that a number of those cases, the plaintiff was chained. I mean, you know, at least with handcuffs. Mm-hmm. And the court has held that the courts have held that the failure to buckle in alone does not constitute a substantial risk of harm. I mean, because if I had failed to buckle you in and I was driving the speed limit on a normal paved road, where would be the predicate for an allegation of substantial risk of harm?
Well, I think that any time that you have somebody buckled in with a belly chain so they can't move their arms, they can't put their own seat belt on, they're helpless. I think any time you do that, you've crossed the line of recklessness.
Well, I tend to agree with you, but that doesn't help you that much because you have to point to clearly established law if you're going to overcome the qualified immunity of the defendant here. And I don't see any clearly established law supporting your position.
Well, I did cite several cases of a similar nature The only difference in those were that the...
But you have to cite a precedent of this court or the Supreme Court.
Yeah, the McCowan versus Morales, that's a Tenth Circuit Court of Appeal. I think that clearly applies in this case.
Where did you cite that case? Because I'm looking at this issue in your opening brief, and it only looks to me like you're relying on the sliding scale. Davis?
I did cite it. I know in the reply brief, I believe I cited it. In fact, I know I cited it in the opening brief as well. I can grab that and get you a case cite to it. I'll do that on rebuttal.
Well, McCowan versus Morales is, and I just pulled it up to briefly scan it, and scanning it would read that this involves a deliberate indifference to serious medical needs.
Yes.
Well, as far as I can tell, that theory of liability appears for the first time in your reply brief. Is that correct?
Well, I'm pretty certain I cited McCowan versus Morales, not only in my opening brief, but also in all the briefing done at the lower court.
I'm sorry, that's not responsive to the question. The question is, if you're making an argument, as you appear to have done in your reply brief,
yes,
regarding deliberate indifference to serious medical needs, have you ever raised that argument before your reply brief? I found no indication that you have.
I will find that and cite you to the page number on it. So I know I did do that. I think that the other factor that comes into play on this is that these are DNR officers, Department of Natural Resources. Their entire working experience has been ticketing people and for seatbelt violations. There's also specific Utah law, 412237, that talks about the inherent risks of OHV, which is different than the vehicles on the street, like many of the other cases cited. I see I only have 2 minutes left. If I could preserve some of that time, please.
Sure.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Cliff Peterson for the appellees. We ask this court to affirm the magistrate judge's decision. Three main points that I'd like to emphasize, if I may. In terms of the subjective prong, this complaint doesn't show any consciousness of a risk. It doesn't show that these officers actually drew any inference of a substantial risk and then ignored it or disregarded that. I would emphasize that. I would also emphasize the objective prong, which was just discussed. But Dexter talks about this causal problem that you have, that just because you're not buckled, that doesn't make the eventuality of an accident more or less likely to happen. So that and other cases establish that failure to buckle alone is not a substantial risk of serious harm. And this complaint fails under both prongs of the deliberate indifference test. In addition, we've argued that the law is not clearly established. In other words, even if this court were to disagree with us on the objective prong and the subjective prong, that this complaint does somehow meet the standard, there's no Tenth Circuit law that a failure to buckle combined with reckless driving, even if these allegations were enough, which they're not, but there's no Tenth Circuit law that says this is in violation of the 14th Amendment.
Were there allegations of recklessness?
No. We're saying this. I don't even think these allegations show negligence. It's a conclusory statement, drove in a dangerous manner, and then a result, they hit a post. No allegations of speed, no allegations of, no plausible, non-conclusory allegations to show that this was either negligence or recklessness. And the McCowan case, first of all, it was decided after. It's not helpful on the clearly established analysis, even if it had been raised in the opening brief, which it wasn't. But also, that's a significantly different factual. The I can't remember if that was an inmate or a pretrial detainee like here, but it doesn't matter for 8th or 14th Amendment purposes. But the prisoner in that case told the officer of a pre-existing injury, told him that he had re-injured it, told him that he was repeatedly, while he was there at the police station, he was in excruciating pain. We don't have any of that in this complaint. We simply don't. So even if that case were to apply because it had been decided before 2018, it does not put the issue beyond debate. And that was that's the point in our brief. And basically considering all of the plausible, non-conclusory, non-speculative allegations in this complaint, the magistrate judge correctly concluded that it did not state a claim for deliberate indifference. It alleged no facts from which this court could infer recklessness or even negligence, and certainly no conscious disregard of a risk to inmate safety.
What do you think about the idea that under the sliding scale test that was cited by your opposing counsel, that when you have a, probably wrong term, ATV, off-road type vehicle, without all the protections of a normal car, I think we can infer the differences there, that the care of the officers in buckling someone in or making sure that they have a helmet or some type of protection is more obvious than when you have a regular motor vehicle?
Well, if perhaps there were enough plausible allegations here. There's nothing about a helmet, for instance, but if there had been enough...
Well, I mean, he didn't have a helmet.
Well,
know that, don't we?
Well, it wasn't alleged in the complaint that that was any basis for conscious disregard or that that in itself was a substantial risk. There's simply no mention of a helmet.
I mean, he has to allege facts. I mean, he's alleges that he was in there. He doesn't allege that he had a helmet. So can we infer that he didn't have one from that?
Well,
he wasn't buckled in. That was alleged. Nobody disagrees with that. He was in an off-road vehicle. Everybody agrees with that.
Well, if you're going to infer he didn't have a helmet, then you also have to infer he didn't have a helmet in the first place when he was riding his own ATPS. I don't think that really helps the plaintiff's
case.
Okay,
I'll give you the helmet.
But most importantly, I think it's not obvious beyond debate. That's the standard under clearly established. It's certainly not beyond debate, and plaintiff hasn't met his significant burden under qualified immunity to meet the clearly established prong. He hasn't given us a similar case like the Sturdivant case that I talked about where you took racial discrimination principles from an equal protection case and says, oh, it should have applied over here in this free speech case. He hasn't given us something that would help us show that this is obvious. He hasn't given us the law and he hasn't given us plausible facts that I understand your point that if you got enough plausible allegations, you know, this and this and this and this, at some point, probably the court could conclude that there was an obvious, you know, that it was obvious, but there's certainly nothing in this case, either on the facts or the law.
Do you think that our case that establishes the sliding scale test is still good law in light of more recent Supreme Court cases?
Well, I think it does have utility. I know I recently argued it in another case several months ago to this court. It still has utility. But the problem is the plaintiff here didn't make a sliding scale argument below. He does mention it. He tries to make his obvious argument here. But again, there's no, I don't think, any plausible facts that would support some blatant, you know, the qualified immunity says it protects all but the plainly incompetent or those who knowingly violate the law. There are no plausible allegations, non-conclusory allegations to show any willfulness, any recklessness, any a willful violation of the law. And even Dexter says, as laudable as seatbelt buckling is, it's failure to buckle is still not unconstitutional. And I don't think the statutes particularly help the plaintiff in this case either. The one statute actually is very similar to the statute in Dexter, which the court wasn't particularly impressed with. That talks about underage drivers, and there's no statute here that says an inmate is to be treated like an 8-year-old child. Basically, we stand on our briefing on this point. If I don't know if there are any further questions. I'd be happy to answer them. Otherwise, I'll submit it on the briefs.
No, no more questions. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.
I did not cite the McCowan case in the opening brief. I did so in the reply brief, however, and I think that's good law. I did look through the allegations.
It's good law in what sense? It's not. It doesn't predate the incident.
It does not predate the incident.
So we can't. So you can't rely on it to establish clearly established law, can you?
Well, I think that. There's some degree of having to be reasonable and having to recognize when something is dangerous and something is unconstitutional. Otherwise, we would never be able to ever get there. I mean, if we have to have a case saying, well, not buckling the seatbelt and driving in a reckless manner, if we have to have both of those, in prior case law, we never get there because we... If you always have to have that precursor to it, you never get there. So I think
Did you argue the sliding scale case law below before in the district court?
Yeah, I believe I did, yes.
Okay.
And
putting that aside for a second, it seems that the Supreme Court has carved out a very narrow area apart from this controlling precedent, Supreme Court or Tenth Circuit precedent, where you've got an egregious violation. A number of cases come to mind, but an egregious violation. Well, if there are a bunch of cases that say buckling in, absent recklessness, is not even a substantial risk, then how do you ever get to an egregious violation in this case? I mean, what would ever move this to that degree?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. Number one, this is a off-highway vehicle, which makes a huge difference. There's statutes that I cited that in Utah, if you're operating a OHV, you have to be cognizant of the train and other things, and I cited that in my brief. Secondly, there's a sign, large sign, and this was put in the facts all the way along, of on the vehicle saying that you may not operate this unless everybody's buckled in. And so they disregard that for my client, but I mean, the important thing is that they agree with it with, I mean, the cops buckled themselves in, so they didn't get hurt, but to heck with any kind of safety for my client, who was in restraints, and I think those types of restraints make it impossible.
Okay, you're running over, so okay. Wrap up the point.
I just think that based upon what we pled and what the case law is that was cited, that we clearly have met the burden to get over a motion on the pleadings. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Case is submitted.